with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Houck.
Good afternoon, everyone, wherever you are in the world at this time. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, helping you find your courage to reclaim that which has always been in you. And I sincerely believe this. In fact, I often tell my clients, in fact, I tell anybody whenever we get on the subject of authenticity and just having the courage to reclaim everything that is, you know, yet to be discovered within ourselves, that we come into the world with everything that we need already, gifts and graces and talents and skills and personality and so forth. We don't lack for anything. And yet, how often do we go through life not realizing the very best parts of ourselves are just waiting to come out? And how many times we just settle for those things in our lives that we can see and this, like, we imagine, like, this is all I am. And this is all I can ever be. And we so often limit ourselves. We don't realize that moving those things that get in the way, just moving them out, integrating them, healing them, allows the very best parts of ourselves, our true self, to come out and just live in tremendous, tremendous relationships with one another. Well, very excited to be with you here today, every Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time. And as you have heard me said time and time again, each and every week, these broadcasts focus on the integration of spirituality and our mental health. And it's all placed within the context of our relationships, the relationship that we have with ourselves and really who is looking back at us every time we look in the mirror, relationships that we have with others, you know, family members, friends, coworkers, colleagues, and our relationship with God or the divine or the universe. And it is no mystery why I place this integration of spirituality and mental health in the context of relationships, because when we think about it, we often receive our deepest physical, emotional, psychological, and even spiritual wounds in relationships. I mean, just think about how you've been hurt. Think about how you've been let down, how you've been disappointed. All of these occur within the context of relationships. And yet the irony is we can also discover our greatest healing and strength and peace and forgiveness and love through healthier relationships. And just take a second and just be reminded of that healing that you received, of the strength and peace and grace and forgiveness and love, and the people through whom all those wonderful things came. And it always brings us back to relationships. And one of the beautiful things about being in relationships with one another is that we have a ripple effect on one another. Because whenever we transform, we also transform others by our presence, our grace, and our understanding. You know, those are things not meant to be kept to ourselves. But first and foremost, you know, forgiveness and kindness and compassion begins with how we treat ourselves. As I had once read a nice story, and I've seen this in counseling situations time and time again, that many people just marvel at the amount of growth and change that can occur in them, the healing that is to them. And I had a colleague one time who told me a story that he was counseling a woman with severe depression, and she would always dress in the darkest of colors, a lot of black, a lot of gray, a lot of dark blue, and it just really fit her mood of just being deeply, deeply depressed. And then one week she came in, he said that she was wearing these bright colors, orange, yellow, bright red, blue, bright blue, bright greens, you know, and just week after week, you know, she just started to dress more colorful and just in bright, bright colors. And he said he just couldn't take it anymore. He had to ask her, I've noticed that you've stopped wearing dark clothes and that you come in here with really bright, bright shirts or bright dresses and things like that. I have to ask, what's going on? And she said, actually, it's from you. And of course, my colleague was just like, well, what do you mean it's from me? And she goes, well, I come in here each week and I listen and we talk and everything. But I really noticed how you sit with me and the kindness that you display and just your presence with me and how you were very compassionate and very understanding and listening and so forth and not judging. And I started to sit that way with myself after the sessions, you know, for the rest of the week and so forth. And it started to make all the difference in the world to her. And it started to lift her mood. She started to be more compassionate with herself. She started to look for ways to, you know, seek healing and so forth. She started to find ways that she could be more loving of herself and more forgiving of herself. And when she was able to do that, her depressive symptoms lessened and lessened and lessened. And she said that she not only started to dress more in bright colors, but as she was more compassionate with herself, she started to become more compassionate with others. And when she started to be more loving towards herself, she started to show more love to others and so forth. Okay. And again, it's just a beautiful story my colleague had shared with me. I've never forgotten that. And it always reminds me of just a simple but powerful teaching that transformation often begins first and foremost with us. But it doesn't stay with us. It is meant to be shared. It is meant to be given away so that transformation can continue. And I also love the quote from Henry Nouwen, who says, just by paying attention to what is going on around us, we often discover that there are people who heal each other's wounds. There are people who forgive one another's offenses and share their possessions and foster the spirit of community and celebrate the gifts that they have. And there are people who live in constant anticipation of the full manifestation of God's glory. Well, I'm Dr. James Houck, and if you would like more information about me or to know a little bit more about me or to leave me your comments about today's show, I just invite you to visit the website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And in case you're not able to spend the whole hour with me, that's fine. These broadcasts are podcasted in case you want to go back and listen again, or you can go back into the archives and listen to previous shows, ones that you had missed and so forth. So if you would like to call in and be part of today's show, I also invite you to call the toll-free line at 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And give me your insights and comments and thoughts today on the subject where death teaches us a lesson. And I'm going to be focusing on the Katha Upanishad. Death teaches us a lesson. Well, as I said, for those of you who might be tuning in for the very first time, is that I'm just a firm believer that we all come into the world with just the wonderful gifts and graces that we have been given. And again, these are not meant to be hoarded. These are meant to be shown. These are meant to be given away. These are meant to help one another. And yet we often go through some unpleasant experiences, or we find ourselves in the wrong place at the wrong time. And out of that, those wounding experiences, we may feel, you know, like we need to hide those skills, those giftedness, or we push those talents way down so that others cannot see it, because perhaps we were using our gifts and talents and somebody took advantage of it, or we felt like they were taking advantage of it and exploited that and had hurt our feelings or whatever the case may be. Or let's say perhaps you've grown up in a family or a place of work or a business that you heard the criticisms, you know, on a daily basis that were just telling you that there's nothing special to you or that you can be easily replaced or whatever. And how that is often very wounding to us emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, and so forth. Okay. But as a result of these experiences, we often tend to go through life from this place of woundedness. Okay, a place of victimhood. And we might convince ourselves, well, what do you want from me? You know, after all, this is all I can ever be, or whatever excuse that we've swallowed, but we've never really taken the time to heal. And we come from this place of woundedness in our relationships. And as the old saying goes, that wounded people wound people. Hurt people hurt people, and often are committing the same patterns of wounding, same patterns of hurt all over again, because never been given an opportunity to heal. But when we are able to heal from these wounds and others, or we move away from this victimhood, we definitely come into each and every relationships from a place of healing and wholeness. And we not only embrace our hachayatas, our uniqueness, but we also embrace the hachayatas, or uniqueness, in others. So, all right. Are you ready? Well, here we go with the Katha Upanishad. Well, let me start off with a question, as I am known to do, just to get everybody on board here. So what was or what is the most valuable lesson you have ever learned in life? What was or what is the most valuable lesson you have ever learned in life? Or for that matter, what was the most valuable lesson you ever learned about life? Okay. What was it? Okay, you have it? Okay, usually we can count on one hand the number of valuable lessons we've learned. Okay, but now let's go a little bit deeper. Who taught you that lesson? Okay, did it come from a book? Maybe. Did it come from a person? Maybe a grandparent, maybe an uncle or an aunt, maybe a parent. Maybe a colleague, maybe a friend. Who taught you that lesson or these lessons? And perhaps most importantly, when did that knowledge from these lessons turn into wisdom? When did that knowledge turn into wisdom to where your life totally changed? Okay, you know, a total transformation occurred. And when did this knowledge that turned into wisdom and totally changed your life, when did this wisdom move you into a deeper place of being everyday teachable? When did it move you to being in a place of just teachability, where you now look at life with just a sense of wonder and honor and grace, and you are so open to looking for the lesson that is there? Well, it's no secret that life lessons often come back around to us time and time again until we either finally get the message or we've learned that, you know, what we needed to learn about ourselves. And, you know, this is something that's just, you know, really characteristic down through history and so forth, but certainly, you know, characteristic of our lives. You know, and this is just simply how God in the universe works, that if we have yet to understand the lesson or to learn from the lesson, don't worry, it will come around again, and it will keep coming until we, you know, finally stop, pay attention, open ourselves up to it, put our ego to the back burner, and learn what it is we need to learn. Okay? Well, I don't know if you've ever looked at it this way, but I feel that nothing teaches us more about life and living than death. Okay? Nothing teaches us more about life and living than death. One of my favorite books is Siddhartha, and you know, I just love the story. It's just phenomenal because, you know, we can just see ourselves in the story as if we are just walking along with Siddhartha Gautama. And so as the story goes, in the early life of Siddhartha, he had everything that it seemed possible to have in life, but despite all his affluence and beauty and, you know, his aesthetics and everything around him, in his early 20s or so, you know, Siddhartha started to become discontented. He just started to become restless. He's just, you know, it's got to be more to this, okay? And yet his father, you know, just tried to provide his son with everything to spare him from being exposed to, let's say, the ugliness of the world. Okay. And so when Siddhartha just said, I'm going to leave the palace, and, you know, his father heard this and like, wait a minute, let me make some preparations before you go outside the gate. And not just in terms of protection, but he wanted to provide, the aesthetics out there, for Siddhartha to just keep on seeing the beauty and keep on seeing the riches and the glory and so on and so forth. But, you know, Siddhartha just said, okay, today's the day. And like you said, the king had already ordered, you know, any person with a disability or anything that would be disturbing to Siddhartha to be hidden away from his view. But as the story goes, one day Siddhartha, when he was out from the palace, he saw an old man, and the old man was bent over and he was kind of trembling, a little shaky on his feet. And Siddhartha eventually became aware of old age. Another time, Siddhartha went outside the palace, saw a sick man suffering from disease and an illness. And still another time, you know, Siddhartha witnessed a funeral procession and a corpse. And finally, on another journey outside his palace home, he met a monk who had this inner tranquility, this glow, despite living a life of an ascetic. And this tranquility suggested to Siddhartha that this monk had finally come to terms with the things that Siddhartha saw earlier, such as old age and sickness and death. And Siddhartha wanted to know more about this. And his father, the king, however, called for more festivities to entertain his son. But somewhere around his 29th birthday, Siddhartha just renounced his regal life. He left his sleeping family, and he set out, finally, once and for all, with his servant. And this decision was not easy for him, in making this choice, he took it upon himself to find out about the origin of suffering as well as how to overcome it. And he did this for his own understanding, of course, but then he also did it for all the people. Well, what is it about our awareness of the aging process or illness and sickness and diseases and death that teaches us about the need to realign our priorities and strive for this inner tranquility? You know, when you think about it, once we realize that we're mortal, that one day our heart's going to stop beating and our breath expires and our brain waves will cease, and everything we see is temporal, but yet what we do not see is eternal. And there are many scriptures out there that teach about death and dying, that we are much more than that. We are much more than our physical selves. And then as a result, how then should we be living? You know, these scriptures just tell us, you know, to kind of turn us back inward and just say, okay, because you are aware of these things in others and yourself, what kind of life should you be striving for? What kind of priorities need to be redirected and so forth? What kind of healing and grace ought to be shown in everyday relationships? You know, we have the Bible, we have the Torah, we have the Quran, we have the Bhagavad Gita, We have the Guru Granth Sahib and so forth. Like I said, many, many scriptures all have this theme of the more we know about our mortality, the more we know about death and dying, the more it teaches us how we ought to be living. Okay. Well, for today, I just wanted to focus on the Katha Upanishad. And don't know if you've ever read it. It's just one of several part of, you know, the Upanishads. And as a whole, the Upanishads are the ancient scriptures which form the final part of the Vedas. And they number more than 100, and they contain both verse and prose, and they vary in length. But they were believed to be written somewhere around 800, 300 BCE in Sanskrit. And the Upanishads are the philosophical scriptures, which are also known as the Vedanta, meaning the end of the Vedas. And did a little research on just the name Upanishad, and you know, it's just fascinating what I found. First of all, the name Katha comes from the Sanskrit term, which means a narration, or referring to a tale, a fable, a parable, a story. And the name Upanishad is derived from the Sanskrit words upa, meaning near, ni, meaning down, and sad, to sit. So when you put those words together, it means to sit down near, or to be close to a teacher or guru to learn an important teaching. Again, this suggests our openness and our teachability. Okay. Well, the Katha Upanishad then describes a spiritual journey of a young boy who is way, way, way committed to self-knowledge. That is, after stripping away all of the worldly trappings, and he really wants to discover the nature of who he is. And he's just not content for any kind of pat answer or don't worry about it, kid. It's just, you know, you don't need to know this. He's like, no, I really need to know this. And so as the story goes, Nachiketa is the boy's name, and he convinced his father to allow him to visit Yama, or the god of death in the story. And so when Nachiketa entered the house of death, Yama was nowhere to be found. And as a result, Nachiketa was not shown the hospitality as any house guest would be. And this oversight was considered a huge disgrace. I mean, it was just like a major slap in the face, just huge. This was big, okay? And as the Upanishads writes, that when a spiritual guest enters the house, like a bright flame, he must be well received. He must be received with water to wash his feet. Far from wise are those who are not hospitable to such a guest. As a result, they will lose all their hopes, their religious merit they have acquired, their sons, and their cattle. So, as a result, when Yama returned and he discovered that hospitality was not shown to his guest, he was extremely embarrassed. And he granted Nachiketa three boons, or three wishes, as we would call them. And Nachiketa goes through the first two wishes, or the first two boons, and Yama, after some discussion, says, okay, I will grant these. But it was the third wish, the third boon, that really troubled Yama, this god of death. And Nachiketa's third wish was about understanding what happens to the soul after death. I mean, he really wanted to know, you know, who am I? And Yama, after hearing such a boon, he tried to avoid fulfilling it. You know, instead of answering the question, he asked Nachiketa to ask for something else, will you? Okay? But Nachiketa was firm in his desire to know this truth, and he didn't give up. But, you know, Yama tried to persuade him. You know, he just said, okay, look, Nachiketa, ask for sons Ask for grandsons who will live 100 years. Ask for herds of cattle. Ask for elephants, horses, gold, and vast land. Ask to live a long life as you desire, or if you can think of anything more, you know, anything more desirable, ask for that. Ask for wealth and a long life as well. Ask Nachiketa to be the ruler of a great kingdom, and I will give these things to you. And I will also give you the utmost capacity to enjoy the pleasures of life. Ask for beautiful women of loveliness rarely seen on earth. Ask for these lovely women riding in chariots, skilled in music, to attend on you. But Nachiketa, please don't ask me about the secret of death. But Nachiketa, he was an awakened soul. He knew that all the treasures of the world are temporary. You know, he knew that a wise person will always choose the eternal good, but a foolish person will chase after those earthly things that never satisfy the cry of the soul. And I have to tell you, I have attended many funerals in my life and officiated at, you know, several. And people are buried with some strange things. And it's kind of probably a Western world twist on Egyptian Book of the Dead, where, you know, people would want to be buried with, like, say, fishing tackle if they were a fisherman. Or one woman wanted to be buried with her sewing kit because, well, she loved to quilt. She loved to make dresses and so forth. And that's who she was. And so on and so forth. They're just people want to be buried with things that were most precious to them. Okay. Almost to say, I'm going to need this in my next life or whatever the case might be. But one of the things that I have never seen in the years that I have been officiating at funerals or even attending funerals and the procession to the graveside is I've never, ever, ever seen a hearse pull a U-Haul behind it. I've never seen that. And so, you know, that old phrase of, well, you can't take it with you, that's true. But how many times throughout our lives are we so tempted to live our lives as if we're going to be able to take it with us? And we let the very good, powerful eternity things kind of slide by the wayside. The things that make a difference in a person's life, the things that we can't put a price tag on, for some reason, one reason or another, we just kind of neglect that. We don't understand it, or we just think, well, you know, that can wait, as if we have all the time in the world, but we realize, you know, very abruptly that, oof, we don't have all the time in the world. And so this dialogue, this conversation that Nachiketa has with Yama is just a powerful conversation. And I really appreciate how Nachiketa was just undetermined, you know, and how Yama tried to persuade him. It's like, don't ask about the, you know, the what happens to the soul after death. Don't ask about the eternal stuff, because I can give you anything you want here on earth. But not to catch a, you know, wise beyond his years, just realize that, no, you really have nothing that you can tempt me with. Okay? And as a result, it's interesting, but in Nachiketa, the fear of death was gone. There was nothing that you know, Yama could do to instill a gripping fear of death into him. You know, not that we're going to be spared from the aging process or sickness or dying, but by knowing these things, we are then compelled to live our lives in quality relationships that uplift others to discover these things in themselves. This story reminds me of a time when Jesus was wandering in the wilderness. I forget what gospel that was mentioned in, but it was a time when Satan tried to tempt Jesus with worldly pleasures and pursuits, and how that conversation went. You know, and pretty much, you know, Satan said, okay, Jesus, I'll give you wealth. I will give you lavish food. I'll give you unlimited power. But each time Jesus said, no, And in his responses, you know, pretty much Jesus said to Satan, you know what? The things that you think you have, first of all, you have nothing to tempt me with. And that fear of those losing those temporary things were just not there. That fear was gone, you know, because once Nachiketa realized these things, that death no longer had power over him or over anyone. You know, whereas St. Paul said elsewhere in one of his epistles, where, O death, is your sting? Where, O death, is your victory? It's been swallowed up. You know, once we know how to live, once we know what happens to the soul at death, once we realize that we are eternal, that fear isn't there. And going through, you know, an illness or a sickness, we have a different perspective. You know, even facing death, even facing our immortality, even going through the aging process, you know, we just do not fear that because we are immortal. So all in all, the Katha Upanishad is about overcoming death by understanding it and learning from it. And immortality just cannot be reached without understanding mortality. So in other words, like, death is here to teach us lessons, to let us know that we cannot take our lives for granted. We cannot become overly attached to things. And once we get that lesson, that fear just dissipates. And so our purpose then is to understand our existence and see how we may use these opportunities to broaden not just our knowledge, but to also establish a base for our, you know, our freedom from death itself. And from the Katha Upanishad, we also learn in this story that you can't bargain with death. You know, you can only make peace with it. You can, you know, with your character or, you know, just being totally focused, spirituality and dutifulness and knowledge and purity and so forth. And how many times does society want us to remember, you know, how a person has died, when all in all, what is transformative for us is when we remember how a person lived and the lives that they touched, and how they loved others. Well, I would really love, speaking of love, I would love to hear your heart on these matters. So again, if you would like to call in, this number is 888-627-6008, and I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity, and I am your host, Dr. James Houck, and I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Okay, welcome back. I'm Dr. James Houck, and you've been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. And just before we go on with our subject today, the Katha Upanishad, I just want to say a word about next week's show. It's entitled Letting Go of Clinging to Problems. Letting Go of Clinging to Problems. And, you know, oftentimes many people just can't imagine something better for themselves, or that they are, that they're worthy of being loved or valued. Okay, and so we're going to take a look at just what is it that we are clinging to when we cling to our problems, and what is this gripping fear that we have. But just by focusing, let's say, on the Four Noble Truths of Buddhism and other scriptures, it is just going to be a powerful lesson of once we let go of those problems, we can take on something that is so much better for us. So, more healthier. Is that redundant? I guess it is. More healthier? Yeah. So, letting go of clinging to problems. So, invite you to tune in next Friday, April the 2nd. Yes, we are going to be in April for letting go of clinging to problems. Okay. So, keep in mind that how we think, so we are. Well, earlier in the show, I was talking about the Katha Upanishad, a teaching from the perspective of a dialogue between a young man, Nachiketa, and Yama, the god of death. And right before the break, I just had shared that the Katha Upanishad is about overcoming death by understanding it and learning from it. Okay, once we learn from death, it just really realigns our priorities. And the more we know of, we are mortal. Yeah, okay, we can embrace our immortality. We know, we realize we are souls. And so death is here to teach us a lesson, to let us know that we cannot take our lives for granted and that we cannot become overly attached to things. Yeah, and that's the key. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have nice things, but in the grand scheme of things, do those nice things have us? Okay, and so our purpose then is to understand our existence and see how we may use, our opportunities just to broaden our knowledge and just establish a basis for our just freedom from death itself. Okay. Well, if you've ever read the Katha Upanishad, it's just an interesting dialogue between a young man and the god of death, or Yama. And this often reminds me of other conversations that show up in Hindu scripture. And the one I'm thinking about is the Bhagavad Gita. And this is, if you've read that or you've heard about it, it's a story between, another dialogue between Arjuna and Krishna, and it all takes place on a battlefield. And again, Arjuna is just like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. Krishna, tell me what to do. And it just launches into this wonderful dialogue that, again, just pulls us right into the story. And just read a couple of excerpts from this, but you'll get the idea of it. And this is Krishna speaking. He says, "Oh, Arjuna, do not care about opposites, like pleasure and pain. Just work. Do not care how your work turns out, but do your work well. This is being wise, and being wise takes you to God. And being wise, you won't be confused, because your mind will concentrate on God." And then Arjuna asks, "Oh Krishna, how can we recognize a wise man whose mind is concentrating steadily on God? How does a wise man speak, and how does a wise man sit and walk?" Well, Bhagavan answered, "A wise man is he who is always satisfied because he wants nothing. He is happy by himself, inside of himself, within his soul. And because he was always satisfied, the wise man neither feels joyful when he gets something good, nor does he feel sad when he gets something bad. He has no hatred, or he has no envy. He's not afraid. He's not angry, and he always stays calm. A wise man is he who controls his mind and his senses. And this means he tries to separate himself from outside objects, even though this is very difficult. Yet a wise man always controls his mind and concentrates on me. And by thinking of objects, a person starts to want them. And a person who always wants things cannot have them all. But then she gets disappointed. Her disappointment makes her angry. Her anger confuses her, and she loses her concentration, her mind, and she is ruined, and she has no peace. But a person who stops wanting things is free from attachment. She is free from loving things and free from hate. And such a person is on the path that leads to peace. And so on and so on. Okay, and just these wonderful dialogues that show up in Scripture that, again, just pull us into the story because they speak directly to the heart of humanity and calls us to really discover who we are as well as what do we go after in this life? What is it that we pursue? Okay. Another beautiful meditation, you know, comes our way to help us remind us or reminds us of the need to realize who we truly are. This comes from the Katha Upanishad itself. He says that the hidden self in everyone does not shine forth. He's only revealed to those who keep their mind one-pointed on the Lord of Love and thus develop a super conscious manner of knowing. And meditation enables them to go deeper and deeper into consciousness. From the world of words to the world of thoughts, then beyond thoughts to the wisdom in the self. So get up, wake up, seek the guidance of an illumined teacher and realize the self. Sharp like a razor's edge, the sages say, is the path difficult to traverse. Okay, and if you've ever seen the movie The Razor's Edge, I think I saw the version that starred Bill Murray. I forget exactly what year that movie came out, but The Razor's Edge. I also want to say Tyrone Powers might have starred in an earlier version, but it is so true, and it just follows this analogy of, you know, we pursue things that we think are going to give us happiness and satisfaction, and they can touch the very cry of our souls, but it can't. You know, the worldly things just simply cannot measure up to the depth of what our soul is crying out for. It's just impossible. So if you listen to the advertisements out there or the way products are marketed, you realize very quickly that it just doesn't, you know, it's not going to fulfill the promise that it puts out there. It just simply cannot. And like I said earlier in the show, it's not that, you know, having nice things, that's not the issue. I mean, we all need food, clothing, shelter, you know, and things like that. You know, we rely on our vehicles. We rely on, you know, certain foods that we like, of course. Come on, let's admit it. We get spoiled, right? Okay, but it's when those nice things start to have us that we will kill for it, or we'll step on a person or step over a person to get those things. That's where it becomes a major, major problem. And that's where we need to go back to the source, you know, and just take a long, hard look at death in the face and just realize that, okay, what is the lesson that I'm failing to understand at this time? Because when we fully understand that we too are going to age, we too are going to get, you know, an illness or a sickness, or the body's just going to eventually wear out. We too are going to die. You know, to come to that point in our lives to say, have I loved another person to the best of my ability? Have I helped them in some way? Have I blessed them in some way? Or have I, you know, just striven all my life to get what's mine or what I think is mine? And I didn't care who I hurt or how many people had to suffer as a result. But what we could truly say, even if I helped one person in this life, you know, just the difference that made to that one person. Because again, we never know what that transformation is going to do for them and in them and through them. Okay. Well, in my own research with this, I've done just quite a bit of research in the area of near-death experiences. And the people that I have talked to who have had near-death experiences have experienced such a transition, such a transformation themselves. You know, they often talk about doing a complete 180-degree turn from how they used to be, you know, and the priorities they used to have and the jobs that they used to go to and just how they treated others and all that stuff. it just, they did a 180 degree turn from the former way of their life, you know, all because they have experienced, shall we say, the other side. And Dr. Kenneth Ring, he's a co-founder of the International Association for Near-Death Studies, he pointed out that there are very distinct, specific lessons that the rest of humanity can learn from people who've had near-death experiences. You know, and these are very, very valuable lessons that, try, you know, to go and to have a near-death experience is, that is to be strongly, strongly discouraged. But for people who have either died on an operating table or died in a car accident or whatever be the case, their hearts have stopped and they've had a near-death experience where they felt like they've been taken into heaven or taken to a place of just utter tranquility, you know, utter peace, and surrounded by just the warmest glow and feeling of unconditional love and unconditional forgiveness. Those people come back because they're either told, not now, or you're not ready, or whatever, and they are resuscitated. They come back, and they are forever changed. You can just tell by looking at their eyes. Okay. But there are specific things, lessons that they have learned. And we are wise, for those who have not had near-death experiences, we would be wise to pay attention and to integrate the lessons into our lives. For example, they often say that they have learned that there's a reason for everything that happens. And we may not know, you know, on this side of heaven, shall I say, but there's a reason for everything that happens, and to find your own purpose in life. You know, find out what that is. You know, don't be a slave to time is another lesson that they're fond of saying, and appreciate things for what they are, not for what they can give you. You know, just appreciate things for the sake of appreciating them. Okay. And don't allow yourself to be dominated by the thoughts or experiences of others. Okay, because how often, many times, we're pulled in one direction or another and our emotions are all over the place because somebody said something to us or somebody had done something. And it's just how we, you know, often get caught up in the life of another and we stop living our own lives. Okay, and right on the heels of that, people who have had near-death experiences often say, you know, look, don't be concerned with what others think of you. Because in the end, it's not going to matter. Okay? And one of my favorite is, remember, you are not the body. And you know, do not live in fear, because not even pain and, you know, certainly not fear death. And be open to life and live it to its fullness. Okay. They also say that money and material things are not particularly important in the grand scheme of things, because helping others is what counts in life. And people who've had near-death experiences, the competitive side of them, nope, that just, it no longer exists. And so they say, you know, don't trouble yourself with competition. Just enjoy life. And they also say that when we die, we realize that we are not alone, nor have we ever been alone. Well, as I said, with my own research in this area, my own studies, I've come to understand that people with near-death experiences are, you know, not only, you know, been radically changed in their everyday life, but they also gravitate to religions and spirituality in new and radical ways. You know, they often seek out new paths or direction of their own spirituality. They also believe they've formed a collaborative relationship with God, and in that they are aware of the connection that they have with God in everyday circumstances or everyday decisions and situations. It's like they don't have to question, is God with me? They know God is with them. Okay? And, you know, near-death experiencers have this incredible desire, you know, or need to help others. You know, they're no longer content with just merely giving, shall I say, lip service. But it's like, if you really want to make a difference in somebody else's life, you do something. You just don't talk about it. And the people who've had near-death experiences are more forgiving, you know, often realizing how much emotional or psychological and spiritual wounding occurs as a result of bitterness or holding grudges. And they just say, let that go. Let that go. And they often talk about feeling and seeing the weight of the wounding in people, that they just been wounded at some point in their life, and it just, they've been weighed down. They've been carrying something for so long, and it's just so heavy because it's turned into bitterness, or it's turned into a grudge or something. So, you know, what about the rest of humanity who has not had a near-death experience? You know, what do we do? And we really want to learn from people who had this radical transformation in you know, these types of experience. Okay, we could read books. Okay, there's hundreds of books out there that have been written about firsthand accounts of people who've had a near-death experience, and these aren't bad. You know, it's always nice to hear the stories, but these are also excellent for educating yourself more fully. But you know, if you truly want to learn and integrate the lessons of, you know, what death is teaching, you know, we need to take a closer look at our lives. And we just have to ask ourselves, okay, where do these lessons challenge me? What's holding me back from living my fullest potential? You know, what concerns do I have? What are some things that I am just so persistent in terms of the negativity in my life? Okay. But there is a persistence that we are supposed to have. You know, a persistence in finding the truth, just like Nachiketa. A persistence in, well, okay, you know, the worldly things, the goods, and, you know, the things that we go after, the things that we, you know, go to work for, so we have the money so we can buy. Okay. But do those things really have me? Can I let those things go? Or do I feel like I have to hang on to them and maybe fight to keep those things? Okay. But that persistence that Nachiketa had with Yama, he just said, you know, look, death, you can tempt me with nothing. And so knowing that he was eternal, knowing that he is, you know, a soul, he just realized that, you know, the lessons that life was teaching him, you know, he just to remain steadfast, to remain consistent and persistent. And eventually, you know, we will find our way. As it says, one of my favorite quotes in The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho, he writes, when you really want something, I mean, like, you really, really want something, all the universe conspires in helping you to achieve it. And I like that because that reminds us that we're not alone. And if you consider the desires of our hearts and what God has placed on our hearts, or what the universe has placed on our hearts, those things aren't just there by accident. And so the whole universe, God, will help us achieve it. We just have to be open. We just have to be teachable. And so dreams and desires are very much a part of life. You know, we all may not have clear and precise goals, but, you know, everybody, you know, entertains some vague idea about the future or where they want to go or what they want to do or make themselves happy or prosperous or how they want to help children or their family to succeed in their lives. And in the end, a few reach their goals. But even in death, you know, Nachiketa remained firm in his resolution and kept looking for the information he thought was necessary for his own liberation, shall we say, and the welfare of other spiritual aspirants like him. Well, as I wrap up this broadcast, I just want to leave you with a favorite story of mine that just brings in the whole message of the Katha Upanishad, as well as other scriptures that clearly teach us that the most beautiful things are often unseen. The eternal things are unseen, and what we see are very temporary. It is The Story of the Diamond by Anthony DeMello. And he writes that Sunasi had reached the outskirts of the village and settled down under a tree for the night, when a villager came running up to him and said, the stone, give me that precious stone. Well, what stone? Asked Sunasi. Well, last night the Lord appeared to me in a dream, said the villager, and told me that if I went to the outskirts of the village, I should find a sannyasi who would give me a precious stone that would make me rich forever. Well, the sannyasi rummaged around in his bag and pulled out a stone. He said, well, God probably meant this one. And he handed a stone over to the villager. And I found it in the forest along a path some days ago. Well, you can certainly have it. Well, the man gazed at the stone in wonder. It was a diamond, probably the largest diamond in the whole world, for it was as large as this person's head. And he took the diamond and he ran away and he said, I'm rich. But all night, he tossed in his bed, unable to sleep. The next day, at the crack of dawn, he woke up and he ran to find the sannyasi. And he said, sir, I'm going to return this diamond to you because I want you to give me the wealth that makes it possible for you to give this diamond away so easily. And therein, he started his own journey of looking within and the things that are most precious in this life. Well, I'm Dr. James Houck, and you have been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. I have enjoyed spending this time with you. Like I said, if you like to leave me your comments about today's show, just invite you to visit the website. But until then, till next week, everybody, please be safe, behave yourselves, and may you always walk in God's peace. Take care.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Friday at noon Pacific Time on PBS Radio TV.